This week on Art on the Air, we featured the dynamic award-winning cellist Hannah Collins with several tracks from her solo debut album, Resonance Lines. Next, we feature the self-described fairy artist, Alice Nebelsack, whose artistry covers a variety of media. Our spotlight is on LaPorte County Symphony's March 13th Verdi and Tchaikovsky concert featuring cellist Hannah Collins.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight someone who's been with us many times before, and we have plans to have him back, from the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra, going to tell us about their upcoming concert, and Hoosier star, the one and only executive director, Tim King. Welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you. It's always nice to be with you, too. Thank you.
Well, you've got a lot coming up. Now, we've had your other concerts on here that you had, but now we're moving into more serious territory for your March 13th concert, Verdi and Tchaikovsky, and also you're going to have a featured artist. So tell us all about that, Tim.
Well, we try to do a concert a year, at least in Michigan City, and so this is going to be at the Whole Craft Performing Arts Center, which some people will know as the old Elston Junior High, but they actually have a very nice auditorium. And so that's going to be on Sunday, March the 13th, 3 p.m., Dr. Carolyn Watson, our music director, will be conducting. We will be performing the following. We'll be performing the overture from La Forza del Testino by Giuseppe Verdi and two works by Tchaikovsky, the Rococo Variations with guest cellist Hannah Collins and Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 5. Carolyn's never conducted in the Whole Craft before, so this will be a new experience for her. And we have never performed the Rococo Variations, so that will be a new experience for us. I've already had several conversations with Hannah, the guest cellist. With our, your audience will be interested to know, not only does she have a degree in music from Yale, she has a degree in biomedical engineering.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. It just floors me. But, you know, it makes sense because engineering and music really go together a lot. She's just been a delight to work with. And she and Carolyn have worked together before, and that's why Carolyn wanted to invite her on this concert. So that one is on March the 13th. The hall holds about 700 people, and so we are very hopeful that we will be able to fill most of that hall. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a very easily accessible hall. There's no steps for anybody. Everything's on one level. Of course, this is in an auditorium, so there's no tables like we have at Civic. And it's general admission seating. The tickets are $22 for adults, $20 for seniors, and students with an ID get in for free. We have tickets available on our website, which is lcso.net, on the classical concert page, the March 13th page, and they're also available at Roxy Music in LaPorte.
Very good.
It's also a very, very comfortable auditorium. This, you know, the seats, the layout. So
it is. It's easy. You know, when I was in Louisville, we had an auditorium that had continental seating, 60 seats from the left to the right. what a pain. You know, this really has two aisles, which is nice, on kind of has a nice center section in the two aisles. So you're right, Esther, there it's really nice to be able to go in one door or the other, and you can get pretty much without having to go over about 16 sets of knees.
True. So how did you...
Excuse me. You know, so that is nice.
This is a very easy listening. I mean, I think most people will be familiar with this set of music that you've chosen. And I think it's appropriate that the power of fate is in there.
Yeah. So thank you. Yes, absolutely. That was one of Carolyn's ideas to do that. I'm really excited to hear Hannah and the orchestra in there, because, you know, we haven't been in the whole craft for 2 years. Because last year we had to have the concert at the Civic because of the whole pandemic situation, having to stay apart from each other. We're still going to say to people that we would prefer that you wear your mask if you're going to be in the auditorium, and the musicians will be doing that. But we're kind of leave that up to the, we're not going to be brutal about it, but hopefully it'll be a nice afternoon and a great way to spend an afternoon. And it's less than 2 hours. That's the other thing. The Verdi is about 9 minutes. The Rococo is about 16. So it's quite a short first half, intermission. And then I think the Tchaikovsky is something like 40 to 45 minutes.
Yeah, briefly back to the Holcraft. I saw that. It's a really well-equipped facility. I saw a production there with the summer youth theater there that a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And it's a really well-done facility. Well, we also have something else coming up for LaPorte County Symphony, which is something great. We have the 2020 auditions for the Hoosier Star. So tell us the details about that.
Well, it's amazing. It's the 17th annual Hoosier Star.
Wow.
We never dreamed it'd be going this long, and it is. And we've already gotten about 20 people so far. We've got a very good early turnout. And so I want to encourage people to go to our website. It's real simple. You can go to HoosierStar.com, and that will take you right to the application page. Or you can go to LCSO.net and click on the Hoosier Star tab, and that will work too. But those auditions are the weekend after our classical concert, and they're March the 19th and March the 20th at Bethany Lutheran Church in LaPorte. The top prize person that will choose 10 finalists, one in the youth category for 17 and under, and five in the youth category and five in the adult category, which is 18 and over. And so those 10 people get to sing a solo with the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra. And as I've told you all before, you know, the $1,000 is a great prize for each group, but any finalist will tell you that the real thrill is to be able to sing in front of a live symphony orchestra in an audience. That really is the thrill. And it works so well. And Carolyn will be our conductor this time for that one. And Alistair Willis, who has been our conductor for the past 3 years, is going to be a judge this year.
Oh, wow. My God, that's great.
In fact, he requested. He said, please nice be a
transition.
Judge. I told him, I said, Alistair, it doesn't pay. He said, I don't care. That's really nice.
So we have a little less than a minute left. Tell us about some of the things coming down the tube for LaPorte County Symphony.
Well, the next concert's April the 23rd, and that's basically a John Williams. It's not all John Williams, but basically a John Williams evening, with the entire second half being a Star Wars suite. We're going to encourage costumes, selfies, and an instrument petting zoo. We're going to have a magic baton competition between our two mayors, between LaPorte and Michigan City. The orchestra. Carolyn might even dress up as well. It's a great family fun event on April the 23rd.
Dressing up?
Oh, we'll see.
That's Tim King from the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra, March 13th at 3 p.m. at Holcraft Performing Arts Center in Michigan City. Tim, thanks once again for being on Art of the Air Spotlight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Thank you. Music you just heard is from our upcoming guest, Chacona. It's a selection from the Resonance Line CD. And our next guest on Art of the Air, she'll be appearing with the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra on March 13th at 3 p.m. for their concert with Verdi and Tchaikovsky. She'll be doing the Tchaikovsky Rococo Variations, Opus Number 3. So we'd like to welcome her to Art on the Air. This is Hannah Collins, that wonderful cellist. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what we always like to have our guests talk about a little bit about themselves. That's what our audience wants to know. I always use the phrase, how you got from where you were to where you are now. Tell us briefly about your growing up, where you grew up, and you know your kind of little story as you got studied along the line.
Sure. I'm originally from Western New York State, sort of near the Rochester area. And I was lucky enough to grow up in a family that is very appreciative of music and also just curious about the world. So I took up the cello when I was 4 years old. My older sister played the violin already, and my mother is a pianist. So my recollection is that I was drawn to the cello, but I think that probably there were some other forces sort of steering me towards an instrument that would complement the family band. There are a lot of physicians in my family as well, so I sort of grew up playing a lot of music, especially chamber music, at home and with friends, and also studying science and just being really interested in a lot of different academics. So I went to study engineering for college. I went to Yale and studied biomedical engineering.
Wow.
And just played as much chamber music as I could. That's basically my what, you know, I would say I'm like a chamber music addict, I guess. You know, I enjoy so much playing in small ensembles with different people and having that be a way of getting to know somebody, both personally and musically. So all throughout my undergrad, I was, you know, always a person that would say, sure, I'll jump in, you know, read some music with you, or I'll play the piece you just wrote, or I'd love to play in this concert that you're putting together. And so I continued on in music after that, studied a little bit more at Yale, and then was in The Hague for a couple of years, and was in New York City doing a fellowship with Carnegie Hall and the Juilliard School called Ensemble Connect. And then from there, I started teaching more and sort of combining teaching with my chamber music life. And I've been at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas for the past 6 years.
Very good. And you didn't, like a lot of people with cello, they sometimes start with violin or viola before they, but you started right out on cello.
That's true. Yeah, I think it was a quarter-sized cello, though, so it was teeny tiny.
Teeny tiny. I have one of those in the house still.
I always think with cello players and also string bass players, it's almost like having an elderly parent. Hard to get them out of the car, how to get them in, and things like it, transport them and everything like that. And then they're out of tune right away. I think harp players have it worse. So
that's very true. I think about that in the airport very often. Like, can't leave. You have to take it to the bathroom with you. You have to carry it everywhere. It won't go on its own. So
well, you're involved in so many different ensembles. And so how does that all transpire? Do you have an idea and say, hey, let's focus on this? Or how do all of you come together in there? Because they're all so different, all of the different things you are involved with.
I think all of my collaborations start with some kind of shared interest, whether it's musical or a mode of working or just feeling connected to to another artist or person. So one of my major ensembles is New Morse Code, which is a cello percussion duo. And people ask us all the time, like, why did you choose cello and percussion as instrumentation? But we didn't choose the instrumentation. We just chose each other as collaborators. We were, you know, friends from school, and we were starting to have a lot of similar experiences just on our own playing contemporary music and commissioning pieces and really getting excited about being part of that process. So we started working together because we wanted to keep making new pieces with that type of process, like a long-term collaborative process. It had nothing to do with what instruments were involved, but it's been a really fun project over the past 11 years now.
It's so exciting and important that you're commissioning new works. I mean, I think it's brilliant. And what does it feel like to be presented with something kind of written for you? And also that means that maybe nobody else has heard it except the composer, and you're the first one to play it. So I'm interested in that. And also, if you'd kind of explain the commissioning process. Does the composer have like artistic license? Is it a partial collaboration? Do you hear the piece as it's developing?
Yeah, I would say, you know, when you're on stage playing a piece, the best feeling is when you feel that you can absolutely advocate for that piece. Like you 100% feel like you can pour your, you know, all of your creative and interpretive and expressive energy into this piece. And when we study pieces from history, sometimes that involves some imagination, you know, like what would this person have been thinking? What would this performer have been trying to convey? Like what was the context in society or in the art world? But when you're working with a living composer, a lot of those questions can be answered. And that's such an important thing to me that I don't go on stage sort of wondering, like, I don't know what's going on here, but I guess I'll play it. You know, but you want to feel like, you know, okay, we have to make sure this moment, you know, expands or feels like this or brings across this emotion. And that's what motivates me to be involved in the commissioning process. So typically with projects that I'm involved in, and with my duo as well, we'll just start by sharing things we're interested in. We'll talk to a composer we want to work with, and we might like exchange other pieces by other people that we like. We might talk about something that they've written already that we really appreciate, or we might just go like see something together, or arrange for some time to spend together, bouncing ideas off each other. We do often encourage the composer to send us like a sketch. It could be like two lines of music, or just to see what's going to work, because it's always so much better to find out right away the composer, especially with percussion, which is very complicated, you know, all the different possibilities. If there's something that's logistically not feasible, you want that composer to know immediately so that we can figure out something that's going to work better and still get the same effect, and not come back to them with that feedback after they've spent months crafting something together and then have to redo it, you know. So it's really almost practical just to stay in touch all the time and to be available.
Exciting.
I'd like you to set up our next piece that we're going to listen to, a Dreaming Chaconne. So tell us a little bit about that, and we'll take a listen to it.
Sure. So this piece is by Kaija Saariaho, a Finnish composer who has written a lot of cello music for her very close friend Anssi Kartunen. And I had a chance to work with them when I was a student, and it was so inspiring to see the way they worked together. And a lot of what I just described, that's what they do. They'll share an idea and they'll figure out together how to make it work. So this piece was a part of a birthday present from Kaija Saariaho and many of Anssi Kartunen's friends to him for his 50th birthday. He plays very often this Colombi Chaconne from the 1600s. And all his over 30 of his friends as a gift wrote him extra variations to tag on to the end of this piece. So this one is Kaija Saariaho's variation.
And let's take a listen to it. This is from Hannah Collins, Resonance Line CD. And that was from the Resonant Line CD from Hannah Collins. Beautiful piece there. So tell us a little bit about how you got hooked up with the LaPorte County Symphony.
Well, as you know, the LaPorte County Symphony has a fabulous music director, Carolyn Watson, just an amazing conductor, Australian. She's up to amazing things nationally, internationally, a great educator, a great performer. And so it's through my friendship with Carolyn that I have been brought into this concert, which I'm so excited about.
And are you performing with any, I know you're doing several ensembles, any other symphonies aside from your teaching duties?
In terms of concertos, here and there, I just I had a great time playing the Haydn C major concerto with the Salina Symphony in Kansas last in January. So it's always just like such a wonderful thing to visit for a few days and get to know the musicians and the community. And I'm really looking forward to it.
Are you still slated for the Geneva Music Fest later?
Yep. That Geneva Music Festival is actually in my hometown of Geneva, New York. And it's a festival that was founded by one of my childhood friends, Jeffrey Hurd, who is a professor of violin in Louisville and a fabulous violinist. So we have always made it a tradition to play together in the summers, and it grew into this big festival, fantastic guests, and so that's something I'll be looking forward to in June.
Well, I'd like to listen to our next selection. It's the Suite for Cello Solo 1, Opus 72, and number 1. I won't set that up. We'll just go right into it. Hannah Collins from the Resonant Line CD.
Thank you.
the Suite for Cello Solo 1, Opus 72, and number 1.
That was amazing. That yes. single cello voice is so exquisitely beautiful and mysterious and satisfying. Thank you so much for it.
We briefly, and we only have about a minute or so left, believe it or not, Hannah, but how has COVID impacted you over this time, the pandemic? And now we're coming out of it. What have you planned to do that you haven't been able to do?
Right. And I want to add to that question. Like, so at this point in your life, what is the next higher mountain you envision? Because this CD was, I mean, just gorgeous. And so, you know, what's your next challenge?
Thank you for those questions. So this CD actually was sort of a product of the pandemic. These pieces, as we were discussing, they represent these amazing relationships between different composers and performers, including some pieces that were written for me. And these are pieces that had a big impact on me really over the last decade. So I've had this idea for this album for 10 plus years, and actually the you know, shutdown of performing allowed an opportunity for me to do that recording. But I'm certainly glad to be back in front of live audiences again.
Well, we're just about ready to wrap up here. Hannah, tell our audience how we can find out about you, website information. And I always want to say Sunday, March 13th, LaPorte County Symphony at 3 p.m. She'll be doing the Tchaikovsky Rococo Variations, Opus 33. So website and how to reach you if they want to hear your music and get your CD.
Yeah, thank you. My website is hannahcollinscello.com, and you can find me on Instagram, cellocollins. And the CD is out on the Sonoluminous label, which you can find on their website, sonoluminous.com, or on Bandcamp.
We'd like to thank you for being on Art of the Year, and as we play out, we'll be listening to one more selection from Hannah, the Pampillon, number 4. Thank you so much for being on Art in the Air.
Yeah, my new favorite piece.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air someone who I've known for many, many years, but also is a local artist from Hammond, Indiana. She was raised in an extended family doing all sorts of things, woodworking, gardening, writing, fiber art. And she's kind of known as the fairy artist, and she'll explain that later to us. And so we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air, Alice Nebelset-Perkowski. Welcome to our show.
Welcome. Oh. Hello.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, like we like our guests to tell us a little bit about their background. I always like to say how they got from where they were to where they are. So growing up, everything like that, whatever you want to share with our audience about, first of all, your personal life.
I was in a family of six kids, and I was very blessed. My parents never said, oh, you can't do this or you can't do that. They always encouraged us. Consequently, my dad, a mechanical engineer, taught us a lot about woodworking. He was a cabinet maker in his spare time. He had done cabinet making from the time he was about 13 years old. And he was a master gardener and a wonderful mathematician. My mom was an artist, and she started doing ceramics when I was about 6 months old. So I always had clay in my veins, and I worked at her shop. We had a shop in Highland for many, many years, and I worked there teaching for 14 years. And at one point, we had 406 students a week, so it wasn't like just a little tiny endeavor ever. There, I had a grandmother on my mom's side who was a phenomenal seamstress. She also did a lot of knitting and worked with color. Her sense of color was something I just always admired. She would just pick out the right things to go with the right stuff. But she also had all these wonderful textured yarns that when she would do an item and she'd have little balls of yarn left, I would get blessed with those little balls of yarn. I did not know how to knit or crochet at the time. But by the time I was about, I believe it was 12 years old, I learned how to knit. And the first project I did was a Scandinavian style knitted hat with knitted in deer and trees, because I would always start with something ridiculously difficult. But I succeeded at getting it done, and I knitted a lot of stuff, and then I taught myself how to crochet later on. And somewhere in there, I was about 9 years old, I started working with a sewing machine and learned how to do hand sewing and everything. And by the time my sister got into high school, she was 4 years older than me, she was taking home ec and would run home from school, teach me everything that she learned that day. So I learned how to sew, and I made a living for many years making and designing doll clothes for American Girls specifically. I had hundreds of outfits I did for them. Out of those outfits, there were actually a couple of them that were takeoffs of Tinkerbell and quite a few other fairies. So I had like these wonderful little enchanted outfits I would do for the dolls.
How much design input did you have? Did they say, this is what we want? And then you do the patterns or?
No, this was all for my own self. I did them, and I did shows like at malls. I did 36 to 39 shows a year.
Oh, okay. So it was close to fit the American Girl doll rather than working for American Girl?
I worked for myself. And
I see.
Like I always advertise the clothes as made for dolls such as American Girl. But ironically, some of the outfits I had ended up in American Girl, like they're cataloged and stuff like that, about 4 or 5 years after I did them. One of them was the graduation cap and gown, which cracked me up because I had done it for about 4 or 5 years, and I had the tassel that went on the hat, and the hat was done so the part that goes over the crown of your head was actually sewn on. Later on, people copied them and they glued them on and everything. But it was just a fun thing that I had made. I hung my daughter's graduation gown up in front of me and copied it.
So your love of miniatures started quite young. So
my love of miniatures has always been there. I did, as a kid, I would play in the sawdust for my dad's Delta table saw. I got to take all the sand out of, or the sawdust out, and it would be different colors, different aromas, different textures. And I would put it in little glass jars so that I would have it. And I used to make stuff out of that, and I would use it for landscaping. And I, at that time, I did out of clay or anything I could get my hands on, I would make little teeny figurines. So yeah, that love of miniatures has always been around.
So just out of curiosity, what different types of things did you mix into the sawdust to manipulate it?
A lot of glue, and sometimes I tried Play-Doh. It didn't work so well.
It's very fabulous. It sounds like you just had so much creative inspiration around you and the ability to explore that at your own pace without any judgment. That's very wonderful.
Yeah, my parents were, you know, I can't imagine having a parent that would say, you can't do this because you're a girl, or you can't do this because you're a boy, or you can't do this because you're too tall, too short, too whatever. They never did that to us.
That's a wonderful, and you grew up in Highland for our audience, so they know a little bit about that.
Yes, I did grow up in Highland, Indiana.
And went to school there, and went in choir with Gordon Wilder, probably.
No, I did not.
You
have
didn't
choir
do that? Oh, okay.
No, I couldn't fit it in. I took art appreciation with Miss Bloom.
Okay.
I
yes.
took a lot of craft classes with Mr. Lampa. My plan was to learn how to do as many different things as I could that I couldn't do at home because we didn't have the tools or the supplies. So I learned how to tool leather in high school. I was the first girl in Highland High School to take welding and wood shop.
Yay.
Yay.
So yeah, I was a pathfinder way back then. It was fun. I learned how to do arc welding, oxyacetylene welding. We did aluminum welding. Got to learn to use the metal lathe, the presser. There was a crimper and presser and everything. We made, I forget what, we made a box with some kind of a paper punch or something.
So, Alice, it's almost like I want to ask, what haven't you dabbled in rather than, I mean, because your list is just so extensive of the materials and the type of art that you make. So I'm going to prematurely, I guess, ask, what is it? What would you still like to learn? What haven't you played around with?
I want to learn lamp work beading.
Yeah, that's
fun. That one just, oh my gosh! It's just like I watch people doing lamp work, and I'm like, I want to do that. I could do that.
Oh yeah, back in I want to say like 2010, there was in Griffith a fabulous studio to teach that. I think they moved out to California, but I think there might be sources near you who teach lamp working.
I'll pass those along later. Yeah, I just say, you know, I got stained glass around the house, and my best friend does stained glass, so it hasn't really like been one of those, oh, I think I'm going to learn how to do stained glass. But lamp work beading, that's just an enchantment to me.
Because didn't you do jewelry? Wasn't jewelry part of your very first art show? Wasn't that in the 70s?
Yes, I did all kinds of heishi, and I got all kinds of shells and Indian artifacts, and I had all kinds of fun stuff that I got to do. And I also made medallion pieces out of clay. Because at that time I was working at my mom's shop. So I did like ceramic textural things and color things and had a lot of fun with that. But they were wearable art. So yeah, I did that. And I actually have gone back to some jewelry making. I have the miniature watercolor paintings I do that are mounted in a bezel. The paintings are about 1.25 by 1.5 inches. And they are the original watercolor painting that's in the necklace. And the bezels have a resin over them. It's a UV cure resin like you would use on your teeth. And it's a little tricky to work with, but then they get on a chain. And right now I'm using stainless steel chains because if I use silver, somebody's allergic to silver. If I use this, they're allergic to that. Stainless steel seems to be the best compromise. But they are now embellished with different gemstones that coordinate with it. And they coordinate with whatever the painting is.
So let's talk about your painting for a little bit. What kind of subjects you do? What kind of media do you work with? You know, what's your inspiration? Kind of your whole work process. You know, how do you start? Like with a photo? Or tell us all about that.
It just depends on what there's times when I'm painting and I primarily do watercolors. And when I started painting in high school and college, I did oils and acrylics exclusively, and I hated watercolor with a passion. I thought, oh, that is just not my cup of tea. I tried it twice, didn't like how it came out. I was like, not something I'm going to do. And then when I started painting again in 2013, all I had on hand was watercolors, and I had watercolor paper that I had, ironically, 9 years before been left as an inheritance from my stepdad's uncle. And it was one of those, well, I guess this is what I'm going to use and what I'm going to do. So I started doing watercolors. The first set of them I did was inspired from a walk at West Beach with a friend of mine. And then the second set of paintings I did was from a hike, a four-hour hike at Dunes Acres. And from there, I started going hiking at Ogden Dunes a lot. I have a very dear friend who lives out there, and I am given permission to park anytime. So I park there and I go hike down to the beach. And in the first year that I started painting, I did over 175 paintings of primarily Ogden Dunes, the lake, and the backwoods. And I am definitely a seasonal painter. I love painting the water. I sat and watched the water for hours. I'd go back and I'd watch the water for hours to get the waves correct. I always, when I have a painting that's got the water in it and the beach, what I hope people feel when they look at it is how peaceful I feel about going to the lake. I don't necessarily want to swim in it.
Are you out there just to absorb it, or do you also bring your paints out there and paint outside?
I don't usually bring my paints a whole lot because there's not really a place I can set up with a little table to put my water on and all that kind of stuff. But I have done some plein air, not a whole lot.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
You know, I want to go back to childhood just briefly, because I'm very curious about something that was mentioned, which was the road trips you took with your family. Now, was the dynamic in the family road trips like somebody says, oh, I want to stop and look at that. Well, would the family stop, or would they say, oh, no, we're going to this destination?
Okay, my dad was the ultimate. Travel with my dad and you're going to learn something no matter how it goes. You would be walking down the streets in Chicago. Like we had a habit of going up to Marshall Fields to see the windows every year. And he'd be walking down and all of a sudden he's pointing up and he's like, now, if you look up here at this building, it was built in. And he starts telling you and narrating this history. And if you take a trip with the Walinda down the Chicago River, you get a whole narrative on the architecture there. My dad was raised in Chicago, but then my grandparents had a farm in Kewaskum and then subsequently West Bend. But my dad never lost a step telling you history of stuff. And you would be driving. One time I went to a family reunion with him in Iowa. And on the way there, he says, oh, we're going to take a road trip here and go off the road a little. And so we go off where we're supposed to be going. And I forget where it was we ended up, but it was like a 2-hour history trip. And so that, you know, his knowledge of architecture, of history during World War II, he designed airplane engines.
Wow.
And so, you know, there was just always an interest. He always liked agriculture. He loved architecture. And so, you know, he just always, always had that going on. And it was usually with the kids, like after my parents got a divorce, my dad had us every other weekend. So every other weekend, we got a fun trip in, well, today we're going here.
Oh, that was so exciting.
It was. And my dad's favorite place was the wood room that was adjacent to the Paul Bunyan room at the Museum of Science and Industry.
Wow.
Wow, that's excellent.
And so now I'm going to take you forward. And okay. Could you describe the experience of starting the Wizard of Oz Fest and how that came about?
I was at a craft show out in Chesterton, and one of my friends said, "Oh, Alice, you got to go see this Yellow Brick Road shop. She's looking for people to be vendors in the shop." I was like, "Oh, okay." So I had my stuff with me, packed in the van, and I drove over there, and Gene was there. Gene Nelson, who started Yellow Brick Road. And she said, "Well, let me see what you do." And I brought it in to show her. And the next week, I set up a store in her shop.
And
I mean, it was.
That history has repeated itself for you many times.
So I was in her shop, and I believe it was the first year of the Wizard of Oz Festival. But back then, it wasn't a Wizard of Oz Fest. Back then, it was a promotional thing that we were doing to have people come to Chesterton. We had a little map, and there were maybe 10 different stores they went to. And if you went to all 10 stores and got your map marked at all 10, then it went into a pot for a grab bag drawing or whatever, a raffle. And I know Milo's flower cart was involved. Katie's ice cream parlor was involved. Gene, of course, was involved with Yellow Brick Road. I can't remember all the other places right now, but you know, it was fun, and it was to get people to come to shop in town. In the second year I was there, we did we started doing a costume contest, and at that point I was a professional clown too. I think I was. No, wait, was I a clown already then? Anyway, we had clowns come from Calumet. Clowns came to the festival and participated. And then I started doing costumes with Marge Knight for the Yellow Brick Road shop. And so our costumes got a little bit more elaborate. And we had a place in town that did horse and carriage rides. So they brought a horse and carriage, and they had their horses painted a different color. And it grew from there really, really quickly. We had Parnell and Mary Ellen St. Aubyn come and do autographs. And I, you know, when we opened the museum, we had a grand opening of the museum, and that was the one originally in South Calumet. And it was just an unbelievable experience. Unbelievable.
Oh, Alice, I think a memoir should be in your future.
Oh, yes. How many years were you involved with the festival?
I want to say it was 5 years, maybe 7. I don't remember exactly. So, somewhere between 5 and 7. I would have to go back and look at photographs. I did help build the museum. We had where people could take pictures by the Emerald City. And I built that Emerald City specifically so people could take pictures. And there also was a Tin Woodsman castle. When we had the open houses, I got to dress up as the scarecrow, and I would stand out there and out by the cornfield. out by the cornfield in the museum, and I got to just have fun with it. A lot of fun. I would stand there like I was a statue. And
I think that's the theme of your life.
There you go.
Have a lot of fun. And then a very intriguing thing I read was that for 7 years you held the international trade secret for processing paint decals on glass.
Yes, I did.
So was that through your mom's work with ceramics, and then it passed to you, or how did that happen?
Well, okay, my mom had designs that she was doing for two different ceramic decal companies, and I wanted to collect her designs. I ended up working at one of the companies, like doing orders and processing things like making lamp kits and stuff like that. But I wanted to do something with those. I was like, oh, I can't just let these sit here and go to waste. So I tried putting them on glass, and everybody kept saying, oh, you can't do that because I got to fire this and da-da-da, you know. And I was like, well, let me try. It took me about 10 or 15 tries at least, and then I started doing it. Because you have to take it just to, like, a couple degrees before the glass jars start to sag. So you get it just there, and then it's in there. I mean, they fuse together. So, yeah, I held that for 7 years, and I, you know, like, I'd go to a ceramic show, or people would come into the shop, and they'd be like, oh, tell us how you do that. And I was like, oh, I can't do that. I try and be real innocent about it. But I held that for 7 years, and then I finally gave people how to do it. And then that was right around the time when Kraft mayonnaise started coming out with jars that had little designs on them. That was back in, what, the 80s, I think it was, maybe 90s. But they had the jars that had, like, little, mostly blue and pink checkerboard designs with something on it. And I thought that was funny because here I'd been doing these jars for years, and now a big company has gone, oh, somebody's doing that. Let's copy it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have just a little over a minute left. Oh. I know you're often seen at the Chesterton European Market, but tell us some of the places that people can find your little fairies and work and all over the place.
The fairies you will be able to find all the time at Pieces of Jade in Chesterton, and also the bookmarks, the necklaces, and stuff like that. I can also be there on special order, or if people need to meet me there. And you can always find me at the Park Full of Art Festival, the Boy Scout Festival in Griffith. It's the Boy Scouts Arts and Crafts Show in Griffith in September. And Park Full of Art is in July. And then also the Munster Arts and Crafts Show in December.
Okay. And how can we quickly find you anywhere online in our last few moments?
I have... just a website a page on my stuff through Nebelsick Gallery on Facebook.
Okay. Well, that was Alice Nebelsick-Berkowski, and thank you so much for sharing your entire artistic journey here on Art of the Air. Alice, thank you so much.
That was so interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, inviting me.
You've been listening to Art in the Air, and we'd like to thank our guests this week on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art in the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP. Art in the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP Station Manager, and Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. Underwriters for Art in the Air, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments, and Mary LeVan, Arts Patron. Art in the Air is always looking for financial support. We'd like to thank our current supporters. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program in particular. We have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA. You can find out support information there. So don't just be an Art on the Air listener. Become a supporter or underwriter in whatever amount you're able to do so we continue to bring you this great content and this great local programming. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world.